Welcome to a new episode of PMCA Research Chat. I'm your host and PMCA Research Chair, Eric Schmoyer, from Barrichello. Our objective is to form and educate our listeners on current and previous research committee-funded topics and personalities. Please subscribe and like us on your podcast service. Check us out at PMCA.com, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. In our first series of podcasts, we're focusing on some of our academic advisors. With me today is Dr. Greg Ziegler, one of our advisors from Penn State University. Dr. Ziegler received his BS in food science from Penn State, his master's in animal and food industries from Clemson, and his PhD in food engineering with minors in chemical and agricultural engineering from Cornell. Greg has been a professor at Penn State since 1988. His contributions to PMCA through papers and presentations, as well as student advocacy and sponsorship, have been a huge benefit to our industry. Please welcome Dr. Greg Ziegler. Did I miss anything in that bio? I did happen to notice you did a stint at Heinz prior to your PhD work.
Yes, thank you, Eric. Well, I'm a native of central Pennsylvania, and as you mentioned, got my BS degree at Penn State University in food science, moving on to Clemson and then to Cornell. That makes my mascots lions and tigers and bears.
Oh, my.
And I did do a two-year stint at H.J. Heinz between my MS degree and my PhD degree, where I worked in product and process design. Since Cornell, I've been at Penn State now for, as you mentioned, 32 years. I have three kids. The oldest is a daughter. I have two sons, and the youngest of which is now starting his master's in food science. So it's a family affair, I guess.
That's phenomenal. So when did you decide to pursue a career in food science?
That was early on in my undergraduate degree. I've always been very interested in science and engineering, those areas. But I also have a practical bent. And food science allows me to take that interest in science and technology and apply it to something that people see every day in their lives. And so that was a real attractive element to me.
So has your experience lined up with your expectations?
Yes, certainly. I find this as a way to really engage people. I mean, food touches everybody's life pretty much on a daily basis. And so as a way to get people interested in science and technology in a very intimate way with them, I think food science has been a really, really good career.
How did you find yourself involved with the student advisor end of things?
Well, as a faculty member, when I returned to academia, there are really two elements. At Penn State, for probably the first 30 years of my time here, we had faculty advisors to undergraduates. So I always had maybe 10 or a dozen students assigned to me as undergraduate advisees. In addition, I had a 70% research appointment and consequently, you know, involved in graduate research. And so I've advised probably upwards of 50 graduate students in that time period.
Have you had any particular piece of research that's given you the most personal satisfaction?
You know, I think that question's almost like asking somebody if they have a favorite child.
I was just thinking that as I said it.
For me, I think the evolution of my research, I'm in an enviable position, especially once you get tenure and you're a full professor, of choosing those projects that spark your interest. And I think I've learned something from every project that I've undertaken. So I think that, to me, has made all those projects worthwhile and personally satisfying.
So how do you pick a project?
How do I pick a project? I have a statement of purpose kind of thing that I give to my graduate students coming in. And the projects, so for me, research has, at least at a university, has a pedagogical role too. So it should teach the student how to do research. So, you know, a good project will teach an advisee the research methods. If they're particularly interested in a specific area, it may be focused on that on that area, for instance, confections. Otherwise, I strongly believe that it should provide novel information, that it addresses a real societal need, so to speak, and that could be a need of the industry, that I learn something from it. So that keeps my interest in the project, that I'm going to learn something out of this project. It could be a new technique. It could be, you know, something about the nature of things, the nature of food. But those are pretty much the elements in choosing a research project.
So how does funding work when it comes to picking these? It's a question I ask everybody, because I think as far along as PMCA has gone, we're still trying to get a grip on how does it work? How much is enough? Do we offer too little? Questions like that.
So it's a challenge. We have a very minimal amount of institutional support to start with. These might come through something like the hatch funds that come from the federal government. But by and large, at least at Penn State, faculty really act as entrepreneurs. So we have to go out and raise our research funding. We try to maintain a balance of that sources of funding. So there might be federal programs, for instance, USDA, NSF, NIH, those typical sources of funding at the federal level. And then again, because food science is a practical field, we have a certain percentage of industry-sponsored research. As far as PMCA goes, at Penn State, because of our long history in working with the confectionery industry, in 1989, some members of PMCA with a certain amount of foresight established an endowment in the department. Now, that endowment generates enough money to fund the stipend or the majority of a stipend for a graduate student. But it doesn't necessarily cover tuition, the research materials and supplies. And so we generally match that with some other institutional monies to come up with the total funding package. I think it has been good, a relationship with PMCA and the research committee. The funding has typically been probably just enough to get a project going. And again, it usually has to be matched with some kind of other project monies, which can be a challenge because, you know, people don't always provide you money to then support someone else's research, right? So this has been a challenge over the years.
That begs my next question, which would be, is bundling a concept that would work, or does it all depend on the principles and the research?
Not exactly sure what you mean by bundling.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is if you had a bunch of entities, principals came together, they all have money, they want to research something that's related to confectionery, is there a way you could tie it all together to increase your income for the particular project while satisfying everyone? Yeah, all right, that's probably possible.
It's a challenge. So we oftentimes want to take on, you know, pre-competitive kind of research. That's been a challenge for me, because a lot of the work I do is in process engineering and that type of thing, which tends to be where people find some of their competitive edge. Not so much for instance, my colleagues that work on the genetics of cocoa. It's much easier for a group of industry partners to get together and fund work of that basic level, because it's much easier to imagine that as pre-competitive work. And so again, mid-1980s, what was the American Cocoa Research Institute funded genetics of cacao program at Penn State, that still goes on now. It's led by Professor Mark Giltman in plant science. So yes, there's a possibility for groups of individuals to get together. Everybody has to understand, you know, what they expect to get out of it. For 10 years, I ran Penn State's Center for Food Manufacturing, and it turned out that there were quite a few confectionery manufacturers in that center. And so sometimes that's where we found, for instance, the, you know, a few extra $1,000 to match with the PMCA fellowship to complete a project. So yeah, certainly groups of individuals can get together and fund work that that none of them would be able to do on their own or would choose not to do on their own.
How does the university or your department deal with the sensitivity of IPs?
That's changed over the years. Now, Penn State has a new approach to that. A new, I say, maybe in the last 3 to 5 years. They realized after doing a 20-year history of looking at what they obtained through licensing of IP and everything, that it really wasn't earth-shattering. And they decided that maybe a really strong IP policy in the university's favor was preventing some funding of research. And so now what they've done is they've changed their IP policy on campus to say that if a company funds research, and that would include paying indirect costs and all that kind of stuff, the company gets first right of, well, they get the IP assigned to them unless the faculty member says, no, this is my idea, I want to retain IP. So the default position right now is for the funding company to retain the IP unless the individual researcher asks otherwise.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. Because we find ourselves dealing with that from time to time, depending on the project we're looking at coming in from the request for proposals, is how would we deal with certain situations? And it always helps to know what the individual backstory is from each institution.
Yeah. Now, I think Penn State was a leader in this kind of approach, but to assume that position up front, you know, PMCA would have to fund the entire project. So that would include,
right,
you know, the graduate student plus any materials and supplies plus overhead, that type of thing.
And that's a question we grapple with too, is how much is enough? And the feedback from your side is always, it's never enough. It's never enough.
Well, I don't know about that, but I mean, you can look at a stipend of, you know, $25,000 and tuition of almost that. So, you know, now you're at $50,000 and then indirect costs are 62% or something right now. So you take another $30,000 and add on top of that, add some money for supplies. And it's pretty hard to really get a complete project done for much less than $100,000 a year.
Wow. Wow. And, you know, I think it's good that people know that that's, for a reasonable project, that's the kind of money you're looking at to get a quality result.
Yeah, a typical USDA project right now is a 3-year project for $500,000.
So that's, okay,
that's kind of the standard USDA project right now.
Is there any piece of your research that's given you the most personal satisfaction?
Yeah, I think seeing, really, again, research at a university, in my view, is pedagogical. So, you know, it's really there to teach people how to think, how to tackle a problem, solve it, bring it to fruition, you know, make judgments about data and information. And, you know, sometimes when you don't have all the information, that type of thing. And so I think for me, the biggest satisfaction is seeing my graduate students go out and participate, get a good job, usually, you know, for the most of them, succeed and progress in their careers. You know, and then they turn around and they bring back their families and, you know, to see that you had maybe a little bit of contribution to that person, you know, having what to them is a successful life is a good feeling.
Has any piece of research taken you in a completely different direction than the initial goal?
Yeah, almost all of them. I mean, if you're really out there on the edge and you're really trying to do something new, your ability to predict the outcome of that your ability to, you know, look into the future and stuff is limited. So typically, I tell my graduate students that research is both incremental and cyclical, in the sense that, you know, you have an idea, you work in the lab, you try it, you usually learn something new from that experience. And then you kind of go back to the original ideas and say, you know, were we on the right track to begin with? And is it going where we think it's going? So, you know, and again, my personal philosophy is I really like to learn something new. So, you know, it's usually a stretch for myself and the students. We're all trying to learn something new. And so we usually do. And those new things are the unexpected things. But those unexpected things usually lead to better insights in the long run than if you're just, you know, well, I know this is going to work. I know we'll get data from this. Let's just do this. And you know, we'll get a publication out of it. We're really looking for those newer insights that lead us to something beyond what our expectations were.
Is there any subject you would love to investigate but haven't had the opportunity?
You know, probably a lot of them. I tend to come up with ideas constantly, and I keep a kind of a research diary of all the things that could be projects. I usually have that around so that if an undergraduate student or a new master's student or something comes to me and says, you know, I'm looking for a project, and it's like, well, here are a few that are kind of on the back burner or have interested me in the past and I haven't had time or resources to follow up on. And, you know, let's find one that you're interested in. You know, sometimes we'll do some of them. Sometimes they're small enough. They're just the kernel of an idea. You don't know whether it could really translate to a bigger project. And so oftentimes I'll have students say, you know, I'm going to be in town over the summer. Do you have a summer internship project for me? And we'll take some of those projects and try to see if there's enough there to make something larger out of them. But yeah, I have a whole book full of them.
Kind of like the unwritten philosophy here at the research committee is we're hoping to get a project that's going to inspire another project so that we don't have to sit back and go, oh, what are we going to do now?
A good project, you know, generally does that. I mean, it's tough to answer. If you're on the edge, it's tough to answer all the questions with just a single project. As I said, you know, sometimes research is incremental and iterative, right? So, you know, you make that progress that you hope for, but it just opens up another can of questions. You have to go from there. It's probably one of the advantages of kind of academic research and working in a university setting, that you can have some of these longer term visions and follow up on things that arise and that are interesting. I mean, I appreciate having been in industry, the need to sometimes get answers quickly, but you know, one of the advantages we have at the university is maybe a bit longer term vision.
What inspires you most by your past and present students' achievements?
You know, like I said, when I see a product on the shelves, I go into the supermarket and I know one of my students has worked on that product or even brought it to market. That's that indirect connection that I have to everyday life. It's not that I myself necessarily have brought all these products to market or anything, but I know that in some small way, I maybe contributed to their success. It's just great. I have lots of students that I still keep in touch with, that some of which, when they pass through town, will stop by and we'll have a chat, and some that have made their way to pretty significant, now that I've been around for 32 years, some that have made their way to some pretty nice successful careers in key spots and companies.
What do you see as being the major benefits in collaborating with industry organizations like PMCA?
Well, for me, again, because I have this idea of a practical bent, for me, it keeps the research relevant. It keeps me grounded to what, you know, food science is an applied science, and I want to see the science applied. I think you can really address practical issues from a fundamental perspective. So that's what I try to do. But the practical issues for me are motivational. And the other thing is that, you know, it aids in student placement. If the students have been working along with companies and they get some exposure to individuals in those companies that might be hiring individuals, again, it helps with student placement. And that's also part of my in the research.
I love the fellowship program and the rotation thing we do every year with PMCA, where we take them through all the sponsor companies. I just love that. Love setting that up. I like to schmooze with the students.
Yeah, no, that's been a great program. And again, now at this point, since 1989, when that was established, we've now graduated 12 students through that program and honored 12 members of PMCA. I think, you know, without a doubt, the ones, at least the ones that I've advised, have thought that this was just a fabulous program. Probably half a dozen of those, so maybe half, are still in the confectionery industry. I know probably 9 out of the 12 at least one time passed through the industry, you know, had some confectionery experience, may not still be in the industry, but but contributed. So, yeah. To me, it's been a really nice way to work with the students. In fact, you know, we've talked in the department about having some, you know, figuring out some other ways that we could get some of these funded, endowed graduate students, almost like, you know, people talk about endowed faculty chairs, but for us, the students do a lot of the work and are very productive. And so, you know, it might also be very advantageous to have endowed graduate scholarships, endowed graduate fellowships like the PMCA fellowship.
It's interesting. We see a lot of those students also becoming PMCA volunteers, so it kind of gets in their blood.
Yep, that's good.
Are you working on any interesting projects right now that you can share with us?
Yeah, I have the PMCA fellow, Terri-Ann Hamada, right now, and Terri-Ann is working on really trying to understand the concept of stringency and astringency perception in cocoa and chocolate products. This is one of those areas where it's such a common experience that people have, but the underlying mechanism of astringency is really not well known. There are several hypotheses out there as far as the mechanism to explain astringency, but no real solid definitive explanation for it as a phenomenon. So we're looking at the perception, the origins of astringency, but also how they're influenced by cocoa processing. And in this case, specifically alkalization or some kind of process similar to that. We know that, you know, one of the major alterations, one of the major changes in fermentation of cocoa and why cocoa seeds are fermented to begin with is the reduction in bitterness and astringency. And so, you know, it's a real fundamental aspect of chocolate and cocoa products. People expect some level of astringency, but too much might turn them off. And this could be especially important in, oh, a lot of the trends now to higher cocoa content chocolates. You know, you get to the point where the astringency can really be a major player in people's perception and their acceptance of those products.
Yeah, I've seen the higher the polyphenolic count, the more bitter it becomes, and it's almost like people are eating the product for the benefits but not enjoying the experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's exactly. And if we want people to consume a healthy diet, it also has to be a pleasurable diet.
Where do you see the future of research through technology, maybe trending topics?
So I see, again, we just got into this, the idea of health. I think in the confectionery industry, that's going to be an important aspect. So how do confections impact health, and how can they be incorporated into a healthy diet? I think that's going to be an issue for a while to come. I think the fact that chocolate now, or at least cocoa, is gaining some perception as being healthy products for you. And I think they are. They contain a lot of the same compounds that your typical nuts and vegetable-based products would. So I think that could be maybe the spearhead to really start to work into the whole idea of health and wellness with confectionery products. I think there are many other opportunities for the confectionery industry to consider that aspect. But again, you know, people don't eat most of their confections for their health benefits. You know, they're really eating them for pleasure. So we have to make sure that we maintain the pleasurable aspects of confectionaries as we work to make them healthier.
In the course of your work, do you tend to intersect with other departments such as computer science, agricultural science?
Yeah, this is one aspect where the deep history of confectionery work, and especially in cacao and chocolate at Penn State, has really come together. We've actually now organized the Cacao and Chocolate Research Network, or CCRN. There are more than two dozen individuals at the university that are members of the CCRN. It certainly transcends food science, although probably five of us, I think, in food science are members. It involves also Mark Giltman's lab in plant science and the folks over there working on the genetics of cacao. It involves folks in rural sociology, so looking at the effect of cocoa growing and marketing on farmers, international agriculture, folks from biology, biochemistry, even history. We have individuals that are interested in history and anthropology, so Maya and Aztec cultures. And I think finally, maybe I can think of geography. So at least all those individuals, when we need to, we go outside even the group that's kind of officially connected to the CCRN. Penn State is a fabulous place for collaboration. It's just, you know, it's kind of the we are a part of research. There are really no barriers to collaborating at Penn State, at least for a faculty member. So if you can get another faculty member in any other organization on campus interested in the project, there are no administrative barriers to folks working together. In fact, we have organizations like the Materials Research Institute, which, you know, explicitly are formed on campus to generate these interactions, and they've been highly effective. So,
final question, and this one I added in light of the current situation, but how do you see the current situation, virtual classrooms, minimal social interaction, affecting food science students and potentially the industry?
So this is a big challenge that we're dealing with right now. You know, do we bring back 48,000 students and 22,000 employees to University Park for the fall? I teach two courses this fall. So my senior level course in managing food quality is really a course in applied statistics. That's fairly easy for me to kind of take online and do by Zoom and work out projects for them to do. But my sophomore level class is a strictly lab class, and it's what I call, let's go have fun in the pilot plant. And I explicitly am trying to get students familiar with working with industrial, at least pilot scale equipment, you know, stainless steel and big motors and things like that, so that when they go on internships or when they get their first job, they walk into a manufacturing facility or a pilot plant and they're not surprised. And that's going to be a much more difficult class to figure out how I'm going to teach that this fall for quite a number of reasons. I mean, one thing is the university has asked us to make each course available not only to students that are here on campus, but any student that might not be able to make it back to campus. And in fact, this morning I got an email from one of my students that's from Thailand, and she's a sophomore, and she wants to know that she'll be able to get her sophomore level processing course in. So haven't answered all those questions yet. Still trying to work out how this is going to best be done. I honestly don't think it'll be quite as good as being in the pilot plant. Can't see how that's going to work, but at least something that is respectable class that they can go on from here.
Seems to be the consensus is, it's great to have the availability, but it's just not the same. It's just not the same with the physical networking versus the online classrooms.
Yeah, I agree. And we've always prided ourselves in a very, well, all of our senior level courses have labs associated with them and that type of thing. And so that's our two big pilot plants. We have a wet pilot plant, dry pilot plant. You know, typically they would get their hands on all kinds of equipment, understand all kinds of different processes. And it's just going to be a challenge to do that this fall. We've been working as a faculty, as a group through Zoom, trying to understand how we'll bring the best experience to our students that we can. So it's a challenge. It seems to change day by day.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. What do they say? You know, the old nugget about, you know, may you live in interesting times, right?
Wasn't that Vulcan? So I want to thank you for joining us today. To wrap up, my guest has been Dr. Greg Ziegler from Penn State University. Is there anything you'd like to advertise or plug here?
Yeah, the PMCA Fellowship, that's on the PMCA site. So there's some information about that. We certainly have in the past sent out advertisements via Food Technology Magazine and things like that. But I'd like to get it generally well known that is available. It roughly rotates every 2.5 years or so. If you think about, it's been around for now 30 years and we've had 12 individuals. So hopefully in the next year or so, we'll be looking for our next PMCA fellow to participate in that program.
Thank you so much for your time, Doctor.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I appreciate having a chat with you folks, and I certainly appreciate the support and the personal interactions I've had with PMCA and PMCA members over the years. It's been a good connection.
It's been our pleasure. This has been another episode of PMCA Research Chat. Please subscribe and like us on your podcast service. Check us out at PMCA.com, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.